Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. Northern Health in Northern BC is working towards closing the health gap between Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginals. Bombsida Co-op student Deidre Condon has the details on that story, and there's a large fiber optic line construction project underway in the James Bay area of Quebec. That's good news for more than 30,000 residents in the area. The details on that from a Nation Talk report. And in Manitoba, it's hoped that a new agreement between the Manitoba Treaty Commission, Canadian Human Rights Commission, and Manitoba Human Rights Commission will help promote treaty and human rights in the province. And there are environmental concerns surrounding the Site C Dam project on BC's Peace River. Not only that, one chief says the province is not telling the whole truth about where the proposed power will be going. And it could be a first for the Canadian National Stock Exchange. Next, Alternative Energy Incorporated is Aboriginal majority owned and is just waiting for the green light to be publicly traded. All these stories plus great news coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The oil rig spill in the Gulf of Mexico is adding fuel to the fire in BC's coastal First Nations fight against Enbridge. Press releases were issued recently by a couple of First Nation communities along the coast in the area where the proposed pipeline will be constructed. The press release from Wet'suwet'en and the Carrier Sicani Tribal Council declares Enbridge's pipeline and tanker project to British Columbia's coast isn't going to happen. The communities took that to a meeting with Enbridge Incorporated executives and shareholders on May 5th. BC First Nations believe they can halt the project based on Supreme Court decisions that say First Nation participation is required in decision-making and land use planning and resource development projects. John Rinsdale, a hereditary chief, says oil spills on land or in water are inevitable and are just a matter of time, and the communities will continue to protect the land and water by opposing the pipeline project. Also in BC, First Nations on the Fraser River from the interior to the coast are demanding the resignation of the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans. They say Gail Shea's department has failed to effectively manage Fraser River Chinook. The 94 First Nations in the area, meanwhile, say they have been doing their part and have had meetings and instituted a moratorium on spring fishing. And the communities have repeatedly asked the Ministry of Fisheries and Oceans to close both saltwater-based sport and commercial salmon fisheries from June to April in order to protect the early run Fraser Chinook. Right now, there's an inquiry into the disappearing sockeye stocks. Fraser River First Nations are worried Chinook are going the same way, and the department isn't doing anything about the issue. And staying in BC, the Council of Treaty 8 Chiefs are vowing to stop a proposed dam on the Peace River. Roland Wilson is the chief of the West Moberly First Nations. He says the proposed Site C dam would have a detrimental environmental impact on the valley.
The valley itself is irreplaceable. It's the only Class 1 and Class 2 agricultural land anywhere north of Williams Lake, I believe, for growing vegetables. It's full of wildlife. It's one of the last connected wildlife corridors in the area where animals can pass north to south on the Peace River.
Plus, Wilson says the government is lying about where the power will be going.
The Site C project, if you listen to the province, is needed because we're running out of power. But if you actually take a look and pay attention to what's going on, it's not that we're running out of power. It's that they want to sell more power to the states and sell more power to industry.
Wilson says the Site C project has been pulled out of the woodwork a few times since the 1970s and has been shelved each time because of the environmental damage it would cause. In Quebec, an unprecedented partnership has been established. The Innu Council of Pessimit has inked an agreement with two mining companies, including Argyx Silver Capital and St. George Platinum. And according to the agreement, Pessimit consents that Argyx and St. George will conduct exploration on part of its ancestral territory. A 100-kilometer radius zone will also be placed around the projects. And in return for that, Argyx and St. George will grant first participation rights to Pessimit in any development project in the territory. territory. The companies will be exploring for titanium, iron, vanadium, platinum, palladium, rhodium, copper, nickel, cobalt, and gold. And if the exploration turns up the metals, an operation phase would create about 450 jobs, plus a titanium processing plant and research center. The agreement also recognizes the title and rights of the Inuit Pessimit. Next Alternative Incorporated could become the only Aboriginal majority-owned company to hit the stock market. Roger Gervais is the Chief Operations Officer of alternative energy company Next Alternative. He says the five-member board is 60% Aboriginal.
It is formed of five people, three of which are Aboriginal. One is Elijah Harper, the other one is Phil Fontaine, and the owner and the majority shareholder is Robert Ireland, and Robert Ireland is First Nations, and he was from Bandy Bay in Manitoba.
In addition to its mainly Aboriginal board, Gervais says most of the shares are also Aboriginal controlled.
There's 100 million shares in Next Alternative, and at this point, Robert Ireland controls 60 million of those shares. So therefore, it assures that the company will stay Aboriginal.
Gervais says the two-year-old company is now just waiting for the green light to be able to be publicly traded on the Canadian National Stock Exchange. And there's a new education tool out for First Nations in Alberta. A course was developed by Lethbridge College and the National Aboriginal Trust Officers Association. It will help learners evaluate the risks and benefits of different investment portfolios for community financial planning. A program developer with Lethbridge College says improvements in investment results would mean a lot more money to help communities. The course will be available online and up and running by this fall. Continuing with education in Ontario, Loyalist College and Tiendanega Mohawk Territory's First Nation Technical Institute are set to receive money from the province. The funding is part of the McGuinty's government's five-year Open Ontario plan to create new opportunities for jobs and growth. Loyalist College will receive $66,000 and FNTI will receive over $34,000 of the province-wide investment of $2.4 million in enhancements for Aboriginal centers at colleges, universities, and Aboriginal post-secondary institutions. John Malloy, Minister of Training and Colleges of Universities, says by improving these spaces, they can help Aboriginal students get the most of their post-secondary education experience. And last year in the province, there were about 11,000 Aboriginal students enrolled in post-secondary institutions, and through its plan, the province would like to see that number rise. First Nation University of Canada's Saskatoon campus is up for sale. FNUC had to put it up for sale to pay for its debts incurred over the past few years, and FNUC was in danger of being shut down by government because of the debts. The Saskatoon campus opened in 1976 under the University of Saskatchewan and offered the Indian Social Work Program. Students at the Saskatoon campus will finish out this year's school calendar, and a professor and three campus staff will be out of jobs due to the sale. The province of Ontario has signed a memorandum of understanding with First Nations in the province. The province promises to support First Nations in the fight to continue point-of-sale tax exemption when the harmonized sales tax kicks in on July 1st. An Ontario news release also states the MOU also includes that First Nations and the Ontario government will work together to address the concerns raised by the federal government relating to data and accounting requirements necessary for the administration of the HST. The MOU will soon presented to First Nations leadership in the province for ratification at a Chiefs Assembly. The Saskatchewan Chamber of Commerce has a new chair and has elected a First Nations person for the first time in its history. Richard Ahenicu began his new job May 5th. He told the Leader Post that his new job means there will be greater participation to assist Aboriginal businesses succeed and take a bigger role in the greater business family of Saskatchewan. Ahenicu has been active in the Saskatchewan business community. Over the past 5 years, he has been the general manager of Northern Lights Casino and been a chamber member for 8 years. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Before it starts falling down over me, in the prairie ground, say, way high, 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 high. Mama lives on a reservation, Touchwood Hills, amongst the elders. elders and the farmers and the buffaloes. She grew up by her ancestors. All the McNabs and the birds of my great, great, great grandfather Pratt.
Shakti Hayes with Touchwood Hills. Northern Health in Northern BC is working towards local health development for First Nation communities in light of complicated health delivery practices from different levels of government. BOMSA co-op student Deidre Colton has the details.
There is a gap in health status between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, but Aboriginal people are more prone to common diseases like diabetes and obesity. David Bowery is the Chief Medical Health Officer for Northern Health in Northern British Columbia.
So I'm sure you do know that there, and are very well aware that there is a gap in health status between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, and that's certainly the case in our region, in northern BC. Although the gap is less in our part of the world than it is in other parts of BC and in Canada, which is something we're interested in, why that is. So the top health concerns for Aboriginal people are similar to what they are for non-Aboriginal people, but in general, Aboriginal people, you know, become ill more often and have higher mortality rates. Certainly, we're all aware of obesity and and the trend towards increasing rates of diabetes as a big problem. And one I think that's under-recognized is the role that trauma plays. So unintentional injury, motor vehicle crashes and off-road vehicle crashes, that kind of thing, has a significantly greater impact on Aboriginal people in general in our region than it does on the non-Aboriginal population. And then, the other cardiovascular diseases and and a variety of, you know, the same, basically it's the same set of things, including cancer, that affects non-Aboriginal people. But in general, the situation is worse for the Aboriginal folks.
How are traditional diets being promoted?
That's kind of an interesting question, and I have to let people know that in our region in northern British Columbia, it's a vast geographical area with many, many small communities and many Aboriginal bands and nations. And our health region is trying to, you know, we recognize that there is a very complex service delivery, very complex service delivery arrangements for Aboriginal people. Federal government's involved. There are provincial processes. There are local processes. There are bands that have been transferred, partially transferred. And it's you know, I actually would say that the structure, all of those structures make it a little bit more difficult than it needs to be probably to have good services for Aboriginal people. But that's the reality. And so Northern Health is trying to focus our services locally to develop good relationships between our local health providers and the surrounding Aboriginal communities. We don't, that I'm aware of, have a specific approach to promoting traditional diets for Aboriginal people, although there's certainly work being done in the province on that. Lots of sort of low carbohydrate, you know, relatively high protein, more traditional approach, lower in refined foods, refined products and sugars and so forth, which has really shown some promise. So there's work being done in the province. It's not a program that we're running, but there's certainly room for it to happen within the sort of local arrangements that we try to make here.
How is your organization helping to combat those issues?
I think the main thing is to try to develop good relationships with, as I said, at the local level and the community, what we call community clusters. We make very sure that the Aboriginal communities that are in those geographical areas are included in our planning. So we have, we're very interested in what we call primary health care, kind of integrated services that do what we call chronic disease management, which is very much inclusive of issues around diabetes and cardiovascular risk factors, hypertension, you know, high blood pressure being another important one. So we try to be as inclusive as we can in providing services that address those chronic diseases. One of our projects that we're very proud of goes back to the trauma one and the high risk of people being hurt or killed on the roads. That we have a project called Road Health with a lot of partners, and we've even held a specific Aboriginal conference on road safety. One of the shocking statistics that got us started was that in the northeast part of our region, young Aboriginal men were 7 times more likely to be killed in a motor vehicle crash than non-Aboriginal people. For both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, the number one killer of young people that's between about age 15 and 40 is road crashes. It's being killed on the roads. And so because many of our Aboriginal communities are small, they're on roads that are not maintained. They were originally built as resource roads. Very little enforcement of laws. Lots of issues around vehicle safety, driver training, impaired driving that occurs. It's really an unacceptable risk, but the good news is that we have been working to do something about that. We're actually seeing some of those numbers start to turn around.
So do you have any advice for healthy living?
Do I have advice for healthy living?
Yep.
Well, yes, I do. And it's a very basic thing that essentially I learned from my grandmother, which is, you know, not to smoke and to, you know, eat and drink in moderation. And get lots of exercise and fresh air. I mean, that sounds kind of simple and almost silly, but I think we're relearning it all the time.
That was David Barry, Chief Medical Health Officer for Northern Health in Northern British Columbia. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Conton.
Aboriginal communities in the James Bay region of Quebec are moving forward with a fiber optic infrastructure project. The project will cost about $28.8 million and will see the construction of over 1,400 kilometers of line completed next spring. The network will serve over 30,000 people in the James Bay area. The IU Communications Network will support the delivery of telehealth, distance education, internet, and new generation mobility services. The following interview with CEO Ashley Eiserhoff of IU Communications is courtesy of Nation Talk.
This is Hyman Gusty for Nation Talk. I'm here today with Ashley Eiserhoff, who is the Deputy Grand Chief of the CRIES and the Chairman of the EU Communications Network. Welcome, Mr. Eiserhoff.
Thank you.
Can you describe to me what this announcement is about?
It's a very significant announcement because of the upgrade and also the change in the way things are going to operate in the north. Whereas in a southern city, they're able to have internet service, which is pretty advanced, and up here it's a little different. But with this announcement today, it's going to significantly improve communications amongst our communities to the south in terms of using the internet broadband system. So it's going to improve a lot of things that we used to travel for before. In order to get, let's say, an example, going down to Montreal for a medical exam, it could be done directly right from our communities. It'll improve things like that, and even communications, and even using the web in a faster. Whereas today, it's a little different because a lot of the communities don't have high-speed internet yet, and we want to advance the communities in the north to have that.
Okay, can you tell me a bit about in the communities themselves? I mean, about their medical services and about the education services?
Well, a lot of the communities right now, I think we use the old technology in terms of what's available today in the north. Now, with this change, it's going to improve telehealth. We're going to be able to have appointments via internet and all that. Right now, the way things are operating, it's like it's very the technology is kind of old, I guess, today in terms of what we have today, and it's going to change the way we operate through governance, government stuff, and also public security facilities that are available today. It's going to improve a lot of the technology that we have that we don't have, I should say. And you know, it's I think in every community throughout the north, somewhat in the same boat as we are, but now we're going to have a direct line to the south, to all the communities here in the James Bay region, and it's going to improve a lot of different things where we used to do things the old-fashioned way. Now the new way of doing things now, like teleconferencing, video conferencing, is going to change a lot of things. Because of our remote areas that we live, we have to travel down south to meet with governments and meet with different people. Now we're going to be able to do it by video conferencing. It's going to be a lot faster and a lot cheaper for the organizations in the north.
In the announcement you made today, you said this was going to be a hybrid system. It was going to actually not only serve the native people of northern Quebec, but it was also going to serve the non-native communities. There were some fairly large centers, probably with a population equal to the amount of the Crees. How did you bring this about?
Well, I think there's been a lot of effort in the past with people that were part of the EU telecommunications or EU communications network. And in terms of working together, we're working with the GMSC and the non-native population in the north. I think a lot of the influence came from the government of Quebec and also the government of Canada, that we have to find ways to work together in terms of communications, improving communications up north. And, you know, we're able to advance the Cree people, but at the same time, we live with a lot of non-native people in the area. So, you know, things go hand in hand, and we're working together, and then now we're able to improve not just the Cree communities, but also the non-native communities living in the area.
When do you foresee this network going online and service actually being available?
Construction's happening right now. I believe that by summer 2011, I think everything should be done and ready to go. But I think some of the communities will already be connected this coming year. Sometime then the rest of the communities will come in eventually.
And did the Grand Council of the Crees invest money in this project, or is it all a government project?
Yes, we did. We're contributors to the to this initiative. The Government of Canada is, and the Government of Quebec are too. And we had a lot of positive and constructive negotiations with the Hydro-Quebec too. So they've been a great help in making this project happen.
I've been speaking today to Deputy Grand Chief Ashley Eiserhoff of the Grand Council of the Crees. Thank you very much, Mr. Eiserhoff.
Thank you.
That was Ashley Eiserhoff, CEO of IU Communications, speaking with Nation Talk. Now here's the Shane Anthony Band with Whole World Before Me from his album Work to Do.
Hey, Mr. Own the News, can you tell me why you only sing the blues? Well, I don't know why you push for war. There's got to be something better in store for me and you. I got the whole world before me, and I got to say it's alright. Everyone come gather round, let's kick off our shoes and put our feet right back on the ground. I don't care what race or creed, 'cause what I see inside of you, you know I got inside of me. I got the whole world before me, and then I've got to say it's alright. Mr. Craig. Tell me how the hell it all began, 'cause I got one more thing in store. Let's kick down this door, 'cause I got love for you, yeah. Well, I've got the whole world before me, and I got to say it's alright. Now burn it down, fellas. I got one more thing to say. Let's kick this car and do 1,000 miles right away. Roll the windows down and let the wind blow through. Hold my hand now, 'cause baby, I've got you, yeah. Well, I got the whole world before me, and I got to say, I got to say, to say it's alright. I got the whole world before me.
The Treaty Relations Commission in Manitoba recently signed an agreement with the Canadian Human Rights Commission and the Manitoba Human Rights Commission. Dennis Whitebird is a commissioner with the Treaty Relations Commission in Manitoba.
For the past year and a half, we've been working with the Canadian Human Rights Commission and the Manitoba Human Rights Commission, as well as my commission here, the Treaty Relations Commission of Manitoba. And we've been hard to add work to establish some common commonality and some common approaches towards how we can do work together and to develop educational institutions and public education with the people that we ordinarily come into contact with. And as a result of the work that we have been doing, we did strike a chord in the area of public education. The Canadian Human Rights Commission has agenda towards public education as well as prevention in the area of promoting and protecting human rights. As well, the Manitoba Human Rights Commission has a responsibility to mediate and as well as investigate, but at the same time doing public education towards the human rights codes that they abide by. And my commission here, the Treaty Relations Commission, basically we have a mandate that's been given to us by Canada, and that mandate has three pillars, and one of them is public education.
Okay, and when we're talking about education, what kind of education will that tripartite agreement be promoting?
Basically, the type of education that it will be promoting is one of What are the human rights? What is the human rights code, and as well as how does the impact of Canada's federal human rights institution and how it'll impact human rights, and as well as Manitoba human rights, and basically we'll go out and engage the general public in terms of what are those human rights, what are the and how you can promote human rights, and how you can protect human rights, and how can you prevent human rights violations? Hopefully, not necessarily prevent, but how you can protect that.
Okay,
and at the same time, we deal with treaty rights. You know, there's of course an indication from our elders and also from our leaders that you know we do have inherent rights that which we gain from our ancestry, and on top of that we have our treaty rights, and on top of that we also have human rights. And although there is in one particular section you have treaty rights that are communal and in nature, and then the human rights code is one of an individual nature, so that there is that difference.
Considering that the issue of missing and murdered Aboriginal women has been skyrocketing, and there's been a lot of international attention on that, along with human rights, was that ever talked about it with your organization and the other two?
That was also part of our discussion with respect to missing and Aboriginal women, missing and murdered Aboriginal women, that there has been very little done, and there was also some indication, some discussion with respect to the level of funding that's been allocated by Parliament to some kind of support systems to the Indigenous communities that are experiencing this kind of loss.
Okay, and I think that's it for me. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
Well, I just like to say that you know, it's a great opportunity for three commissions to work together and to share knowledge and to basically provide our community in terms of here in Manitoba as well as throughout the country that there's we're exercising a spirit of coexistence, and that's what our treaties state. You know, treaties were very particular in terms of coexistence with the treaty, with the Crown and First Nation people, and now we're putting that into effect, and we're hoping to work together and to develop common strategies in terms of public education.
That was Dennis Whitebird, a commissioner with the Treaty Relations Commission in Manitoba. Next Alternative Incorporated is an alternative energy company which is Aboriginal majority owned, and the company is just waiting for approval to be traded publicly on the Canadian National Stock Exchange. That may be a first for an Aboriginal majority-owned company. The two-year-old company comprises of two holding companies, one in Canada and one in the U.S. The company is up to some exciting things in the alternative energy industry, and Roger Gervais is the Chief Operations Officer of Next Alternative Incorporated.
We were told, I haven't done the research, but we were told that there is, in Canada, no Aboriginal company that is publicly traded on a stock exchange. This comes from people who are very knowledgeable about the exchange. And I met with the president of the Canadian National Stock Exchange 3 weeks ago, and he confirmed this fact that there is, to his knowledge, no Aboriginal company that is on a public exchange.
Okay, so I have a couple of other questions. When you're saying 60% Aboriginal owned, what does that mean, and who are those people?
Okay, well, there is a number of first of all, the board of Next Alternative is formed of five people, three of which are Aboriginal. One is Elijah Harper. The other one is Phil Fontaine, and the owner and the majority shareholder is a Robert Ireland, and Robert Ireland is First Nations, and he was from Sandy Bay in Manitoba. So basically the board is 60% Aboriginal. Then the shares, there's 100 million shares in Next Alternative. And at this point, Robert Ireland controls 60 million of those shares. So therefore, it assures that the company will stay Aboriginal.
And how old is the company?
Company was formed 2 years ago. Basically started as a high-tech green company looking for products that would help our world try and fit itself. And we ran across some technologies that were green, and one was a battery, a carbon nanotube battery, and the other was a M-fuel production machine. The machine itself produces a similar to a diesel type of burning fuel, but it burns 100% clean. There's no soot, there's no remains, there's no carbon deposits or anything. We then supported a group of engineers and scientists who are developing a pancake motor. The motor is 13 inches in diameter, 4.5 inches thick. It is no moving parts. It will develop some 545 pounds of torque at the outset. It is designed to propel vehicles that are used in either golf courses, like ball pickers, grass cutters, the little trucks that they use to take care of the greens. It can also be applied to electric cars, but we're going to concentrate on the golf industry to start with. We've also got John Deere and Caterpillar interested in making equipment designed for golf courses, who are going to be testing motor. It should be, we've seen two prototypes up to now. We think the next one is going to be production version one.
Okay, and are you, with respect to the golf equipment, are you going to be working with golf companies and golf courses that are also green, because there are international designations for some golf courses that don't use pesticides and herbicides and the like?
Yes, and apparently from, I believe, 4 weeks are about ready to implement regulations that golf courses can no longer use any gas-driven. So that means their golf carts, their equipment, their maintenance equipment will all have to be electric powered, and that's why we're gearing the company for that primary market.
Uh-huh, so that's your in.
That's right.
Okay, and I also understand that you were saying you were recently in the U.S. Speaking with some tribal groups.
Yes, we were speaking with some tribal groups in southern Colorado. We're looking at doing a joint venture on a new technology, and I'm sorry, but I can't disclose of it right now. But they would fund the research and application of it, and it would enable this company, as well as they're in the gas and oil business, and it would bring them into the green technology on that side of their business ventures.
That was Roger Gervais, Chief Operations Officer of Next Alternative Incorporated. And now I want to give a shout out to Scott Raymond in Cochrane, Ontario. He's been a loyal Bombsida listener, and he requested a song from Shane Yellowbird. So here it is, Scott. This one's for you. Pickup Truck.
Like to hit the streets, see just how many pretty girls we can meet
after 2 a.m. on the weekend. There was a 9 out of 10 standing outside the bar. My name is Shane, how you like me so far? Was my pickup line. It's been working since 99. She didn't even say a word. Turned on her heel and flipped me the bird. Lately we don't have the effect we used to have on the girls. Me and my old pickup truck. These days we don't pick up much. But there's chrome on our hood. Man, we're looking so good when we're looking for love. I know we'll be rolling again. Someday soon, somewhere around the bend, I know we'll have better luck. Me and my pickup truck. 10 was still looking at me. I asked her, are you from Tennessee? Because baby, you're the only 10 I see. She smiled back, much to my surprise. I need a map, cause I'm lost in your eyes, was the last thing I said before her burst in my head. At the side of the road, wondering how our dynamic duo went so wrong. Me and my old pickup truck. These days we don't pick up much. Baby pink furry dyes and a can of Old Spice, making us too hot to touch. I know we'll be rolling again. Pickup truck. Maybe we need to give this thing just one more try. Bigger tires and a new paint job with flames on the side would really pimp out our ride. Me and my old pickup truck. Pick up much, but I know in a while we'll be driving in style. Right on out of this rut, I'm sure we'll be rolling again. Someday soon, somewhere around the bend, I know we'll have better luck. Me and my pickup truck, just a couple of fixer ups. Pickup truck.
The Council of Treaty 8 Chiefs in BC is unhappy with the province's move to remove the proposed Site C dam from regulatory oversight. The proposed dam, which has been shelved about three times since the 1970s, could go ahead on the Peace River, making it the third dam on the river. And according to Roland Wilson, chief of the West Moberly First Nations, that move would wreak environmental damage. Plus, he says, the province is not telling the whole truth about where the power would be going.
Well, the Site C project is the third large-scale hydroelectric dam being proposed on the Peace River. We have the W.A.C. Bennett, which has created the Wilson Reservoir, and the Peace Canyon Dam, which has created the Dinosaur Reservoir. And Site C would be the third facility on the Peace in our territory that would create the Site C Reservoir.
Okay, and how long has that project been in the works?
Well, it's been going around approximately 30 years now. It was first introduced 30 years ago. It got shelved back then because the environmental impacts were too significant and there was no need for the power, so they shelved it.
And so now that project is back on the table.
Back on the table. What comes up, it seems to come up every 10 years, right? In the 70s, it came up. It was shelved in the 70s for the same issues. And in the 80s, it kind of came back up again, and it got shelved again for the same issues. Kind of skipped the 90s, but now in the 2000 era here, it's back on the table, yes.
And what particular issues do you have with the project?
Well, it's going to be the third dam in our area here. And these are large impoundments of water. The Williston is the largest man-made reservoir in Canada, if not North America, I believe. The thing is massive. It's huge. According to BC Hydro, the power generated from the W.A.C. Bennett Dam powers one in every three lakes in BC here. The Site C project, as if you listen to the province, is needed because we're running out of power. But if you actually take a look and pay attention to what's going on, it's not that we're running out of power. It's that they want to sell more power to the states and sell more power to industry. None of the energy that's going to be produced by Site C is going to go to residential homes. But yet they need everybody to believe that.
And how will the project affect your community?
Well, it's right in our backyard. It's the last piece of river that's left before you get into municipal areas like Fort St. John, Dawson Creek, and places like that. And it's kind of the last stretch where the Site C Dam is being proposed. It's just up from Fort St. John, which is our largest non-Aboriginal community here in northeastern BC. And it would flood the water all the way back up, all the way up to Hudson's Hope, and create a large reservoir. Now, the reservoir itself is, I think it needs to be clear that we're not opposed to the generation of power. What we're opposed to is the flooding of the valley. And the valley itself is irreplaceable. It's the old Class 1 and Class 2 agricultural land anywhere north of Williams Lake, I believe, for growing vegetables. It's full of wildlife. It's one of the last connected wildlife corridors in the area where animals can pass north to south on the Peace River. With the Dinosaur and Williston Reservoir, they fragmented populations of animals. The caribou in our territory have been fragmented to the point where they're actually endangered now under the Species at Risk Act, and they've been identified as a species that is threatened. So we haven't been able to hunt the caribou since they flooded the Williston Reservoir. And where we're located here, it's called Treaty 8 territory, and there were certain treaty promises made. And one of them was our ability to continue a way of life after we said it never entered into treaty. And hunting caribou was one of those ways, you know. And caribou is a key species that we focus on quite a bit. But it's also impacted the fish in the Finley River, the Parsnip River and the Peace River, which is basically impoundment water for the Willis Reservoir. They're contaminated with methylmercury. We can't eat any of the fish there. The bull trout are being extirpated. The Arctic grayling out of the river system is being extirpated. The mountain sheep, the mountain goat, with Site C, one of the last corridors that the grizzly bear in North America have is right here. And the flooding of the Wilson Reservoir will sever that corridor. We'll cut it right in half, and we'll wind up having a southern caribou and a southern grizzly bear and a northern grizzly bear like we have with the caribou.
And so the province is also including this in its new Clean Energy Act, am I right?
Well, that's what they're saying. We just got seen the new Clean Energy Act, and we reviewed it. This project doesn't fit. By any means, it doesn't fit their clean energy policy, and it doesn't fit within their Clean Energy Act. They've massaged it to a point where they've made it fit, but you know they engineered the Energy Act so it would fit in there. You know, when the Kyoto Accord came out, they rewrote the clean green energy part in the Kyoto Accord so BC would fit in it over here. So like the it's by no means clean. We've produced a report out here that shows the greenhouse gas emissions that will be released by this, the carbon sink that will be lost from flooding the valley. The mere fact that they're putting agricultural land underwater, you know, that's lost forever. There's no coming back from that. And the way everything is going right now with global warming, right now it's May 4th, and we're in the middle of a snowstorm up here. You know, we got 3 inches of snow laying on the ground up here, and it's you know, things are changing, and they're changing drastically. And if there's ever any inkling that we may need that land for growing food on, there's no way that they should even be considering putting it underwater.
That was Roland Wilson, chief of the West Moberly First Nations in British Columbia. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means working together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website, bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.